Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, why talking about race is key to understanding a country's debate over gun laws. Following the mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso, President Trump placed blame on mental illness, a connection gun violence expert Jonathan Metzl calls the height of irresponsibility. Metzl says there are concrete steps we can take to prevent gun violence, but to do so effectively, we must acknowledge the connection between white privilege and gun rights. This is an argument Metzl lays out in his new book titled Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. I spoke with him Tuesday morning. Dr. Metzl, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
After the shootings in Dayton and El Paso, we heard President Trump blame mental illness. Tell us your reaction.
On one hand, I can understand and empathize with why people turn to narratives of mental illness in the aftermath of mass shooting. Mass shootings are so traumatizing, and they come seemingly completely out of the blue. And so I think there's a natural human drive to say that only an insane person would do an act like that, kill innocent people. And so on a personal level, I understand the valence and the power of the narrative of turning to mental illness, and I'm sympathetic to it. But I find it highly irresponsible when politicians like President Trump perpetuate that narrative as an explanatory narrative. What President Trump said was mental illness pulled the trigger. And the minute I heard that, I really honestly thought, here we go again. Because this assumption that people with mental illness are themselves ticking time bombs, or that mental illness is this sole explanatory factor, is really a gross oversimplification that limits our understanding of what happens in mass shootings rather than enhances it.
Of course, he also said, I think the quote was, mental illness and hatred pulled the trigger, not
correct.
The gun.
That's correct. And, you know, so I've been studying this issue for quite some time. I'm a psychiatrist and a sociologist. And I guess my dispute with it is not that issues like a person's mental state or hatred are involved. But when we look and we tell the story of what happens in mass shootings, it's very often that a person's mental state is just one of many different factors that go into mass shootings, and other factors including gun laws, access to firearms, past history of violence, substances are often play a part, misogyny, racism. And so part of the reason that I try to refute this narrative is to say that when we limit it just specifically to these questions of mental illness or hatred, we're really oversimplifying what happens. And the other factor is to suggest that mental illness pulled the trigger is really, again, an oversimplification. There's no mental illness that causes someone to shoot someone else or attack someone else. And so, again, I think that what we're doing is we're telling one story about a mass shooting, but not the story we need to be telling.
Also interesting that the president and others had talked about video games as being part of the problem. And yet, research up to now does not seem to carry on that idea.
If you just think of all the people who play video games versus the number of mass shooters, it's a similar claim to the mental illness claim, which is, you know, I think there are issues with video games and with violence and misogyny in video games, but there's no statistical correlation between playing a video game and committing a mass shooting, just like there's no statistical correlation between a diagnosis of mental illness and committing a mass shooting. And so what we're dealing with here are really unsubstantiated generalizations that, again, I think make it harder for us to tell the real story about how can we prevent future mass shootings.
There is a place, I gather, that you believe we ought to be focusing on when it comes to guns and gun policy, and that's race. Tell us why.
Well, a lot of the work that I've done looks not directly so much at mass shootings, but really at guns more broadly. I just finished a book that came out a few months ago called Dying of Whiteness, where I told kind of the history of race and guns in this country. And the story I tell in that book is really about the interconnectedness between core questions of guns, you know, who gets to own a gun, who gets to carry a gun, and assumptions about what it means to be white in America. And the arguments that I've made are that, you know, the gun debate very often is a reflection of much bigger conversations about race and privilege in this country, and in ways that we really need to look more closely at. In the book, I look closely at gun suicide, for example, and how arguments about gun rights go hand in hand often with rising rates of gun suicide in white Americans. And so, again, just to oversimplify a little bit, I think that there are questions about race that we're not addressing when we talk about guns.
And for you, you say this issue goes back hundreds of years. Explain what you mean.
There's about a two-century history of gun rights and race being connected in this country. In pre-colonial times, for example, who got to carry a gun in public? Well, the answer is that it was people who owned land or plantation owners, people like that. And also, it was a right bestowed by wealthy white Americans on working-class white Americans in order to not allow uprisings or revolts by what they called Negroes at the time, or Indians, Native Americans. And so in a way, carrying a gun was a white man's privilege in pre-colonial America. And that history really played out again and again, really over the next several centuries, where time and again, when African Americans would want to carry guns in public, there were responses by, for example, the Ku Klux Klan or after Nat Turner's rebellion. And so really the story I tell is that these core questions that seem like they're just rooted in the present moment about who gets to carry a gun in public and what kind of cultural response do they elicit really date back centuries, and they help shape our present day attitudes in which very often white gun owners are held up as patriots, whereas African American gun owners are coded as criminals or gang members or other untoward associations.
So what about state and local court rulings and legislation? How have they affected this idea of who is allowed to carry a gun and how we in the general public view that right?
Well, in the book, I tell the story of Missouri. That's the state where I grew up. Missouri is a pretty interesting case because in the Missouri that I grew up in, there was a long history of hunting and a kind of tradition of gun ownership, but there were also what seemed to me at the time to be reasonable gun laws. You know, you had to get a permit. You had to, in some instances, demonstrate proficiency. There were permit laws where you had to actually go be interviewed at sheriff's offices in order to get the right to carry a gun. And so before about 2008, Missouri was a state that balanced a history of gun ownership and hunting and responsible gun rights with public safety. And what started happening in Missouri is after about 2008, 2009, there was a kind of takeover of the legislature by pro-NRA politicians who made it ever easier to get a gun and really eliminated all kinds of gun regulations. And so the story I tell in the book is that as it became ever easier in a state like Missouri to carry guns, what happened was that rates of all kinds of gun-related injury and death started to soar, including gun suicides in white Americans. And so the story I tell is the kind of double-edged sword between respecting gun rights on one hand and the dramatic rises in injury and death that occur after states overturn a lot of their gun regulations.
I must say, if I walked into a restaurant and saw someone other than a member of the police force who was carrying a gun, I think I might walk out. But there are so many people these days who have a license to carry a gun and carry it openly.
Right. I mean, that's what happened in states like Missouri or Tennessee right now, is that the places where people could carry guns dramatically expanded. So in Tennessee, for example, people have rights to carry loaded guns into bars, into college classrooms, into parks, really all, pretty much all public spaces, hospitals. And gun rights see this as an expansion of their constitutional gun ownership rights. But these go hand in hand with dramatic changes, not just in injury and death, but also with the ways that people engage with each other. I see this as a cautionary tale personally, based on the data in my book. I show how without reasonable regulations, public health is put at risk. But there's a big debate now because there are several cases pending possibly before the Supreme Court in the fall that will take the kinds of gun laws we see in places like Missouri and Tennessee and nationalize them. And so this question of kind of gun rights versus public health, I think, will become even more urgent in our country going forward.
I gather you are not against gun ownership.
Again, I've grown up in many spaces where people have pretty complicated and often divergent opinions about this. Again, I grew up in Missouri. I now live in Tennessee. I have many friends on all sides of this debate. I personally feel like states and cities should be able to make decisions that balance gun rights versus public safety. And even though I myself am not a gun owner, I've seen the role that guns play in people's lives. But I also powerfully feel that cities like New York, for example, or Los Angeles, should be able to set gun laws that work the best for them. And I feel like that's really what's at risk right now. You know, we have so many guns in this country and people feel so strongly about them that it just seems unrealistic for me to say we're going to make some dramatic change that takes away people's guns. That's not what I'm advocating. But I do think that there are very urgent questions about how we balance these questions that are going to be becoming even more important as the Supreme Court cases play out over the coming months.
When we come back, more from Jonathan Metzl.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Jonathan Metzl. He's the author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. I'm so interested in the title of your book, Dying of Whiteness, because in it you explore, among other things, how white working class and poor people are literally supporting policies that are killing them. Explain what you mean.
The core argument of my book is kind of twofold. On one hand, you know, I really show how the politics that claim to make working class white America great again, the way that President Trump has framed it, on the ground level, end up making the lives of many working class people, including white working class people, harder, sicker, and shorter. What I do in the book is I track what happens if you live in a state in which the core policies that the Trump administration has been supporting, things like rejecting the Affordable Care Act and upending healthcare reform, and really not allowing that to progress, massive tax cuts that benefit wealthy people or corporations and end up taking funding away from things like roads or bridges or schools, or even very pro-gun policies. On one hand, these are the core positions that make America great again, as Trump puts it. But what I show in my research is that for many working class white people, these policies end up being as dangerous as asbestos or not wearing seatbelts in cars or secondhand smoke. They literally end up shortening people's lifespans. And so really what I talk about is this trade-off between a notion of greatness that might play to people's ideological sense on one hand, but in terms of just their biological or medical self-interest, it ends up functioning almost like a disease risk factor.
Going back to the earlier part of our discussion and what happened earlier in the history of this country, do you still see that gun ownership is mostly in the hands of and supported by white people as opposed to those of other races?
I guess the argument I make in my book is that there are racial charges that dictate the ways that we think about gun ownership. And so certainly opinion polls for the past several decades have shown, for instance, that white Americans are far more supportive of broad gun rights than our African American communities. And if you just look at rates of gun ownership, many of the so-called gun super owners are white Americans who live in rural areas. So in part, I would say that the data plays that out. And I do think that if you just look at the current politics of, for example, the NRA and factors like that, that there are profound racial issues. And so what I'm saying is not so much about the biology of particular gun owners. I realize there are many divergent opinions on all sides, but really that the gun debate is a reflection of a larger conversation about race, and we should be talking about that at the same time.
There was a news report just this morning about a driver being stopped by two policemen because of some infraction of the law, and the driver pulled out a gun and shot first the one policeman and killed him, and then the second one was terribly injured. So it does strike me that you are wondering whether whites are directing policies in favor of white people.
Well, yeah, I certainly agree with the question in that I think that the more you put guns in the middle of intense social interactions, the more there's the possibility of a fatal outcome. And I think we see that again and again, where interactions that might be navigated in a very different way end up having bad outcomes when guns are involved. And it's not just guns. It's also, for example, guns in bars, as one example that we have in Tennessee, where if people are drinking and there are guns present, there's a far greater likelihood that there's going to be some kind of shooting, and you can kind of go down the road. So on one hand, I think there's a broader social question about just what does it mean to put guns in the middle of, you know, things like road rage, for example, or disputes or workplace disputes, factors like that. And I think really those are the places where we don't want guns in a way. So there's partially there's the social question. And then, you know, there's a lot of research just about asking people why they feel they need guns in the first place. And in my book, I interviewed a lot of people and tried to get at this question of why do you feel that you need guns? And again, white Americans who I spoke with would give me answers like, you know, there could be a gangbanger or a carjacker or somebody like that who could be coming after me. And so people really felt like they needed their gun for protection, very often protection against racial others. But really, the biggest risk that I found in my data was that having a gun in the home increased the risk of having an accidental shooting or a suicide. And so this fear of racial others very often blinded people to the risk that guns presented just by having guns in their home or under their bed or on their nightstand.
How do you believe that President Trump or Fox News play this fear up, or do they?
I think President Trump is playing in some pretty familiar stereotypes. I mean, when he's making claims like mental illness pulled the trigger, for example, it replays a stereotype that people with mental illness are ticking time bombs. as I show in a lot of my research, the mental illness stereotype is also a very racialized stereotype that goes back several centuries, just about who we see as crazy versus who we see as sane. But I think the bigger issue is that when we play in these stereotypes, we're not having a real conversation about ways to balance gun rights with public safety. And so are there particular laws? Are there particular regulations? Are there particular interventions that we do? But the minute we're all talking about stereotypes of mental illness, we're not really having a real conversation about best ways to move forward.
Of course, in the case of El Paso and that shooting, the shooter himself seemed driven by racist beliefs. He used language apparently similar to the president's and similar to Fox News.
Right. We really need to ask ourselves, I think, as a society, are these kind of instances aberrations, which they are in many ways, right? Many people hear the president's rhetoric, but hardly any go on to commit acts like this. But are they aberrations or are they amplifications and reflections of the spread of broader ideologies that we need to resist? And so it really feels like, even though this has been building for a while, this really feels like a crisis moment, not just because of mass shootings, but because of what mass shootings reflect about the direction that our society could be heading in if we don't make some dramatic changes.
And what direction do you see that?
As you've identified, I consider myself a researcher and a centrist. And so I found it remarkable when I was doing research in my book, how many people I met who were willing to consider other alternatives. Even in the most pro-gun areas that I spoke to, I consistently found people who were willing to say, you know, gosh, I'm totally pro-gun, but I would consider background checks or I would consider red flag laws. So I feel like on a day-to-day level, doing my research, I became very hopeful that people would be able to navigate complex issues across polarization. But unfortunately, there's just no space for that in our country right now. You know, you're either on red or blue, and Twitter doesn't allow for any middle ground and factors like that. And so I guess I remain optimistic that we can reclaim some kind of middle space, but it sure feels impossible sometimes.
If you had your dreams come true and your optimism were to be borne out, what would you like to see done? What do you think we could do to balance both gun ownership with the kinds of limits that would make our society more safe in which to live?
To be clear, I think we have some urgent issues on the horizon. I do feel strongly that, again, states and cities should be able to set gun laws in a way that work for them. And so I think there's potentially some pending Supreme Court legislation that will not allow New York City, for example, to set its own gun laws eventually. And so I do think that on one hand, it's important to recognize that we need to highlight that if a city like New York is doing something right, has relatively low rates of gun death, we should not force it to adopt policies that are worse. And so on one hand, I want to be clear, I really do worry about what's coming down the pike. But I also think that there are, you know, over the past couple of years, the emergence of some middle ground positions. I'll give an example of what's called a red flag law, which gets a lot of press these days. A red flag law is a law that allows family members or loved ones or law enforcement to identify someone who might be at increasing risk of gun violence and to temporarily take away their firearms while some kind of assessment is made. And a red flag law is an example of an intervention that was made in conversation between mental health people, activists, law enforcement, and gun rights activists sometimes, in order to think about some middle ground in which people don't feel like their guns are being taken away forever, but it also protects public safety. And so I'm hopeful that something like a red flag law, which has bipartisan support, is an example of the kinds of things we can do to work across the political divide to address this problem.
What about gun show loopholes?
Close them. If President Trump is serious about this background check issue, then it's important that we make sure that background checks are done on all gun sales. And again, if you pull people across the country, this is an example of what I was talking about before, that there's broad support for broadening background checks and enforcing background checks. And so certainly you shouldn't be able to get a gun without a background check in one situation and not in another. So certainly I think that these loopholes need to be closed.
And what about ownership of assault weapons by individuals?
Most gun death in this country happens by a handgun. I understand why people feel very strongly about assault weapons. And I personally don't feel like there's a strong need for weapons of warfare in people's daily lives. My concern about this is that when we're talking so much about assault weapons, we're not talking about the kinds of weapons that lead to the most death in this country. And so really, I think that pushing for common sense regulations about gun suicide, about handguns, factors like that, I think will ultimately be more effective, even though, again, I understand why they're so charged because of mass shootings. Although, again, of course, you know, it does seem like the data supports that we had lower rates of death in mass shootings during the assault weapons ban in the 1990s.
I, in closing, want to take you back to a visit you paid here in Washington, where you spoke at Politics and Prose, and there was an interruption to your talk. Tell us about what happened.
I was in D.C. actually speaking at an important anti-racist book festival, and I gave a talk at Politics and Prose. And, you know, it was a lovely spring day. I was giving this talk. Quite a few people were in the audience. And at the moment in my talk, I was giving a book talk. And I was talking about how my father's a Holocaust survivor. He and my grandparents came to this country through the generosity of people in the United States. And I was talking about how great America can be when it's the most welcoming, it's the most generous, it's the most confident, and how that's great for our country. And at that moment, I looked up, and coming in from the back of the bookstore were 10 people with bullhorns who marched to the front of the store and really took over the event for about 5 or 10 minutes and started shouting racist slogans about America for white people and this is our land. And at first, people were terrified. This was happening right next to Comet Pizza, where there was the Pizzagate shooting, and people didn't know what was happening at first. And then there were just remarkable acts of bravery. People from many different backgrounds started standing up and booing and shouting and trying to get the people to leave, which they ultimately did after about 5 or 10 minutes. It turned out to be a white nationalist group that was going around disrupting events like mine. And after they left, instead of going on with the book talk, I basically stopped and we just had at that moment, we all kind of seemed like victims. And so we had a conversation about what just happened and what does this mean about the kind of country we have, the kind of country we want, and what we need to make change. And so it was a very, at a moment, very scary experience, but it turned into a pretty productive conversation.
It does seem to me that that must have been a pretty frightening situation. Congratulations on your book, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thanks so much. It's been my honor.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urd-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.